The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 22nd/December 29, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. This is the issue they call the Faces of 2017. And boy, has it got a busy cover drawing on it. I'll try to give you the gist of it. It looks like there are a lot of people at the President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. He's in the very foreground. He's just taking a big swing with his golf club. Off to his left is the football player Colin Kaepernick kneeling down. To his right is Putin is clapping. And over by his golf bag, it looks like China President Xi Jinping is pulling out a club. Behind a tree in the background, we see, looks like Robert Mueller is in some spy clothes, and maybe Michael Lynch is peeking out from behind the tree. We have two women giving each other a high five, and one of them is stepping on Harvey Weinstein, who is up to his neck in mud. Driving away from the scene looks to be Jared Kushner and I guess it's Ivanka, Trump's daughter, looking back. And then the last figure in the scene is the Korean leader riding on a rocket missile, like a cowboy with his hat off. So quite a cover. And with that, we will go right into the main stories and how they were covered. Actually, let me back up a minute. We'll take the newsy stuff this week, and then in the next program, we will go into more of the year in review type articles. So the main stories and how they were covered. The Democrats' shocking win in Alabama. What happened? In a stunning setback for President Trump and the Republican Party, Democrat Doug Jones this week beat scandal-ridden former Judge Roy Moore to become Alabama's next U.S. Senator. The first Democrat to win a Senate seat in the deep red state since 1992, Jones secured just under 50% of the vote, about 1.5% more than his opponent. When he is sworn in, likely in early January, it will reduce the GOP's Senate majority to 51-49. Alabama's special election to fill Attorney General Jeff Sessions' old seat burst into the national spotlight in November when the Washington Post reported that Moore was accused of making sexual advances to teenage girls, one as young as 14, another who said he sexually assaulted her at 16, when he was in his 30s. The allegations prompted Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Republicans to drop their support and funding. But Trump, encouraged by his firebrand former strategist Steve Bannon, stuck by the controversial candidate and strongly urged his supporters to back him. After Jones' victory, Trump claimed that he had supported incumbent Senator Luther Strange in the GOP primary because he thought Moore would struggle in the general election. "I was right," he tweeted. Jones, a 63-year-old former prosecutor, overcame Alabama's deep red demographics with a large turnout by African Americans and strong support from affluent suburban residents. Jones, who will hold the seat until Sessions' original term expires in 2020, said the race had been about dignity and respect and the rule of law. Moore called for a recount and said he would wait on God. What the editorial said. Long before he was accused of being a child molester, Roy Moore had disqualified himself from serving in public office, said the Washington Post. An unabashed theocrat, he was twice removed as Alabama's Supreme Court Chief Justice, once for installing a Ten Commandments monument in the courthouse, once for refusing to marry gay couples. He said Muslims shouldn't be seated in Congress, equated homosexuality with bestiality, and even waxed nostalgic for the era of slavery, calling it a time when families were strong. But the child molesting allegations were the last straw at a time when Americans are finally taking sexual abuse of women seriously. Moore's defeat provides heartening evidence that partisanship in America still has limits. Republicans dodged a bullet in Alabama, said the Wall Street Journal. Sure, there will be a cost of defeat with a reduced majority. The party will find it harder to pass major legislation. But had Moore won, Democrats would have made him a national symbol of sexual harassment for the 2018 midterms. GOP lawmakers would have been under heavy pressure to expel him from the Senate, in addition to facing distracting questions about his toxic views every day. What the columnist said. Well, Bannon really can achieve the impossible, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. He somehow got a pro-abortion Democrat elected in one of the most reliably Republican states in the country. As part of his destructive quest to depose McConnell and upend the establishment, the former White House strategist has promised to support more like challengers against almost every GOP senator up for re-election next year. If he doesn't want more Democrats elected, Trump better tell his pal to back off. Despite Moore's uniquely awful track record, his defeat indicates that the GOP is in deep trouble, said Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com. Alabama hasn't had a competitive race for national office for decades, and Trump won the state last year by 28 points. This year, the Democrats have overperformed in elections all across the country, in Virginia, Georgia, even Montana. With Trump's approval ratings sinking to low record lows, Republican voters are staying home, and Democrats are voting at unprecedented levels. Jones' triumph is a dark portent indeed for Republicans in 2018, said John Podhertz in the New York Post. Democrats now need a net gain of only two seats to take back control of the Senate. Recapturing the House increasingly looks within reach, and the party is already running 13 points ahead in generic preference polls. Trump has to do something to get people beyond his solid one-third of the nation to think well of him. If he doesn't, the GOP is going to be smashed into a million pieces. We're on the controversy of the week now. The title is Mueller. Is his Russia probe tainted? Special counsel Robert Mueller has some explaining to do, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. 7 months into his probe of alleged collusion between President Trump's campaign and Russia, it was revealed last week that over the summer, Mueller quietly fired one of his lead investigators, Peter Strzok, after learning that Strzok had expressed anti-Trump opinions. In thousands of text messages with an FBI lawyer named Lisa Page, with whom Strzok was conducting an affair, the pair agreed that Trump is, quote, an idiot and, quote, a loathsome human being. And the prospect of his election to the presidency was blanking terrifying. That's not the only evidence that this investigation is tainted. A key member of Mueller's team, Andrew Weissman, not only attended Hillary Clinton's election night party, but also sent a gushing fan email to Acting Attorney General Sally Yates when she refused to implement Trump's travel ban. Enough is enough, said James Robbins in USAtoday.com. The stakes in Mueller's investigation are too high to let it be conducted by a clique of politicized government agents. The probe must be suspended. Well, this was utterly predictable, said Will Bunch in Philly.com. As Mueller closes in on Trump, the panicked president and his toadies in the right-wing media are teeing up justifications for him to fire the special counsel. During Watergate, Richard Nixon did fire the special prosecutor, but got major pushback from principled Republicans. Nixon also didn't have the support of today's state-run media, Fox News, whose foaming-at-the-mouth commentators are now howling that Mueller is illegitimate and corrupt, and that anti-Trump agents at the FBI and Department of Justice should be taken out in handcuffs. That hysteria has no foundation in fact, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Mueller, a registered Republican appointed FBI director by George W. Bush, is a man whose reputation for integrity Republicans praised when he was named special counsel. When Mueller found out about Strzok's text, he fired him. Besides, prosecutors and FBI agents are allowed to hold and express political beliefs in their private lives. They are required only to keep those beliefs separate from their work. Since the investigation began, it has yielded a mountain of evidence of contacts between Trump's campaign and the Russians, two indictments, and two plea deals with cooperating witnesses. No amount of bias can create evidence of crimes that weren't committed. Trump's defenders are only taking a page from the Bill Clinton playbook, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. When Clinton was being stalked by Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr, a Republican, his team conducted a scorched-earth campaign to portray the investigation as a politically motivated witch hunt. That made it easy for Democrats to acquit Clinton during the impeachment trial. The current attacks on Mueller aren't designed to justify a firing, which would be as disastrous for Trump. It's to give congressional Republicans who'd vote on impeachment a ready cable TV-tested line of defense, focusing on the unfairness of the prosecutor. Don't pretend we've been here before, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. Remember why Trump and his team are being investigated. For possible cooperation with a foreign power's interference in our presidential election. Republicans seem to be saying, too bad the president lied or broke the law, or that Russia tried to tilt our election. Since one investigator called Trump an idiot, let's just forget the whole thing. If Republicans pull off a cover-up of this brazen, we're in big trouble. This is a recipe for autocracy. It was a good week for the search for E.T. When billionaire astronomer Yuri Milner announced an effort to detect any radio signals being emitted by the strange cigar-shaped object that recently whizzed through our solar system. Some astronomers wonder if it's an alien space probe. It was a good week for Kim Jong-un, whose hackers have reportedly stolen an unknown quantity of Bitcoin from online exchanges as a way to raise funds for the North Korean regime. The value of the so-called cryptocurrency has soared by more than 1,500% this year. It was a good week for holy copy editing when Pope Francis' suggestion that the phrase "lead us not into temptation" in the English version of the Lord's Prayer might be better translated as "do not let us fall into temptation," so as to remove any suggestion that God might be tempting us on purpose. But it was a bad week for helpful ideas after Australian Army Captain Sally Williamson proposed having sex workers service troops in combat zones to ease their loneliness and help combat veterans with PTSD. After complaints from outraged spouses, the suggestion was withdrawn. It was a bad week for popularity after Richard Close, 74, was elected to the Laurel, Montana City Council, even though he didn't run. Close, who won with 3 write-in votes, says he'll serve since he has the time. And it was a bad week for self-incrimination when a Long Island, New York woman, due in court on marijuana charges, parked in the spot reserved for the chief of police, where she was found smoking marijuana and ticketed again. It was like Cheech and Chong, all the smoke coming out of the car, said Chief of Police Bill Rica. And before we move on, there is a short note here. Kids' health program on the brink. Congress isn't expected to renew funding for the popular Children's Health Insurance Program until at least January, Axios.com reported this week, leaving many state programs in imminent danger of running out of money. Funding for the joint state-federal program, which provides health insurance for 9 million low-income children, expired at the end of September. Some states, including Virginia and Colorado, have warned families that their children's coverage will end by January 31st if Congress doesn't renew funding, and Connecticut and Utah are expected to send similar notifications this month. Congress included temporary measures to keep CHIP running for the rest of the year in its most recent stopgap spending bill, but lawmakers have yet to fund the program in 2018. We're on the briefing page now, titled, "O Christmas Tree." For most Americans, a tinsel-decked tree is a holiday essential. But why do we put decorated firs in our homes? How did the custom start? As with many Christmas traditions, its roots go back to pagan times. Some northern European pagans believed that the sun was a god and that he went through a yearly period of ill health in the winter. They put up evergreen boughs on the winter solstice around December 21st, the shortest day of the year, the evergreens reminding them of all the greenery that would grow again when the sun god regained his strength and spring arrived. Ancient Egyptians followed a similar tradition, adorning their homes with green palm fronds to mark the return of Ra, a hawk-headed god who wore the sun as a blazing crown. And ancient Romans used fir trees to decorate their temples during Saturnalia, a winter festival in honor of Saturn, the god of agriculture. Early Christian theologian Tertullian wasn't a fan. In the second century, he told his fellow believers to leave the plants and trees to the heathens, over whom the fires of hell are imminent. When did Christians get on board? That's a matter of ongoing dispute. The Eastern European cities of Tallinn and Riga both claim to have hosted the first Christmas tree. Tallinn in 1441, Riga in 1510. Each city says the Brotherhood of Blackheads, an association of local unmarried merchants, shipowners, and foreigners in Livonia, now modern-day Estonia and Latvia, erected a tree in their town square over Christmas, danced around it, and then set it alight. Around the same time, medieval Germans were incorporating evergreens into their own Christmastime rituals via the Paradise Tree, an apple-adorned fir that represented the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden. But Christmas trees didn't make it into the home until Martin Luther, the founder of the Protestant Reformation, supposedly experienced a very special Yuletide vision in 1536. What did Luther see? The German theologian was taking a nighttime stroll through a pine forest near his home in Wittenberg when he glanced up and was awestruck by the thousands of stars twinkling through the branches. The wondrous sight reminded him of Jesus departing heaven for earth at Christmas, and Luther raced home to recreate the holy scene for his family. Dragging a tree into their parlor and decorating its branches with lighted candles. Other Germans started covering their own Christmas firs with gingerbread, gilded apples, and other trinkets. Some preferred to deck a single yew branch with colored paper and ribbons, a ritual witnessed by English poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge in 1798. Under this bough, wrote Coleridge, children and parents exchange presents with kisses and embraces. When did the trees arrive in the U.S.? They were brought to Pennsylvania by German settlers and may have even played a part in the Revolutionary War. Legend has it that as George Washington was crossing the Delaware River on December 25, 1776, Hessian mercenaries fighting for the British were busy decorating trees and getting drunk. Suffice to say, they were in no state to fight the ensuing battle, and lost. But Christmas trees didn't become de rigueur among fashionable society until they were granted the royal seal of approval. In 1848, the Illustrated London News published a sketch of Queen Victoria's Christmas tree at Windsor Castle, a gift from her German consort, Prince Albert. The image was reprinted in Philadelphia's Godey's Ladies book, with the Queen's crown and Albert's mustache removed to make it look more American. East Coast ladies went wild for the heartwarming scene, and Christmas trees became a staple of the American home. What about decorations? Thomas Edison's assistant, Edward Johnson, was the bright spark who dreamed up electric Christmas tree lights. In 1882, not long after Edison invented the light bulb, Johnson hung a string of 80 red, white, and blue bulbs on the tree in his New York City home and invited journalists to come and gawk at the illuminations. Some four decades later, on December 24, 1923, President Calvin Coolidge lit the National Christmas Tree, a 48-foot balsam fir decorated with 2,500 colored bulbs. Department of Commerce official Frederick Fiker had conceived this ceremony, hoping it would boost the burgeoning electricity industry. It did, and started a custom that's been observed by the White House every year since, except during World War II, when the tree wasn't lit, and in 1979, when only its topper was illuminated in honor of American hostages in Iran. Fiker was always confident of success. If you get the President of the United States 2 years in succession to do a thing, he said, he will always do it. What do other countries do? In Japan, you might find origami swans, paper fans, and wind chimes hanging from the branches. In Spain, a tree trunk is filled with goodies, like toffees, nougats, almonds, and dates. And children take turns whacking the stump with a stick to dislodge the treats. In Brazil, Christmas lands in summer, but some people cover pine trees with little pieces of white cotton to simulate falling snow. Traditions vary widely, but across the world, Christmas trees are a universal symbol of festive joy. There's a kind of glory to them when they're all lit up, said humorist Andy Rooney, that exceeds anything all the money in the world could buy. And we'll read a few of the columns now. The first is from Albert Hunt at Bloomberg.com, titled Trump's Inaction on Opioids. In the fight against the country's devastating opioid epidemic, President Trump is a no-show, said Albert Hunt. Most of the 175 Americans who die each day from overdoses are from the working class and rural communities that pushed Trump to election victory. Yet since his commission on the opioid crisis called for dramatic action in its report on November 1st, the president has sat on his hands. He hasn't asked Congress for additional funding for desperately needed addiction treatment and prevention. In fact, he has endorsed GOP proposals to cut funding to Medicaid, which provides addiction treatment to the poor. Trump's nominee to head the Office of National Drug Control Policy, Pennsylvania Representative Tom Marino, had to withdraw after revelations he sponsored opioid legislation that Big Pharma essentially wrote. The president then named as his opioid point person White House senior advisor Kellyanne Conway, a pollster and spin doctor with none of the required experience. What's Trump thinking? Mounting a serious battle against the opioid crisis would be a win-win, a bipartisan move that would garner him both great press and gratitude from his base. Yet the president seems to think declaring opioid addiction a national emergency will suffice. From Italy, we have pizza, our gift to the world. Neapolitan pizza is now officially a world treasure, says Elisabetta Moro. UNESCO, the United Nations Cultural Agency, has just added the Naples-born art of pizzaiolo to the list of the intangible cultural heritage of humanity. It's a welcome recognition of how a people transformed a meal born of poverty into the most famous comfort food in the world. Mediterranean peoples have for centuries baked quick-fired bread, but only the Neapolitan pizza makers made it a masterpiece of taste. The breakthrough came in the 18th century when bakers in Naples began selling a flattened round focaccia topped with anchovies, oil, garlic, and oregano. The buyers were the workers of the poorer classes, such as carters, bricklayers, and washerwomen. Pizza was a cheap street food that could keep you satisfied all day. Beloved by all, affordable to all, it is ideal for sharing, which makes it an authentic community product. That, more than its inherent deliciousness, is what the Heritage Award honors. Pizza is a food that creates forms of conviviality, exchange, and mutuality. It is now made all over the globe, and while every culture has adapted it, none has improved upon it. Thanks to UNESCO, we know that the only authentic one is ours. This is an international How They See Us column. Joy and anger over Jerusalem decision. U.S. President Donald Trump and Trump's announcement on Jerusalem is a victory for Israel and especially for the Jewish settlers, said Nadav Shragai in Israel Hayom. By formally recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel last week and by pledging to move the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv, Trump has poured a bucket of ice on the heads of those who wish to keep Jerusalem divided. An Israeli president, Reuven Rivlin, said, "There is no better or more beautiful present for the state of Israel in its 70th year of independence." Trump has recognized the facts on the ground produced by Israel over time, that the seat of the Israeli government is in Jerusalem, and that some 200,000 Jews now live in East Jerusalem, annexed from Jordan in the 1967 Six-Day War. "Now we must capitalize on this recognition and return to build in Jerusalem our eternal and undivided capital." Facts on the ground do not justify the recognition of an illegal occupation, said Khalif Ahmad al-Habtour in Arab News. "There's a reason why no other country has its embassy in Jerusalem and why the United Nations has refused to recognize Israel's annexation of Arab-majority East Jerusalem, seen by Palestinians as the capital of a future Palestinian state. If an armed man broke into a house and threw the owners out, no court would legitimize the theft on the grounds that the theft's slippers under the bed signified a new reality. No nation will follow the U.S. in this provocative and counterproductive outrage. Trump has merely succeeded in destroying whatever remaining veneer of credibility the U.S. had as a fair mediator between Israelis and Palestinians. That means the two-state solution is dead," said Hani Akal in the Ramallah, West Bank-based Al-Ayyam. "The main rival Palestinian factions, Hamas and Fatah, now have but one path forward. They must end their squabbling and launch an intifada against the occupation." "But where is the Arab world?" asked the Daily Star in an editorial. "Protests against Trump's declaration were perfunctory affairs, except in Jordan and Lebanon, which both have large Palestinian populations. And while the Arab League condemned the U.S., it failed to take any punitive steps, such as ordering a boycott of American products or the suspension or downgrading of its ties with Washington." Perhaps the Arabs realize Trump's declaration is sort of fake news, said Itamar Eichner in Yedioth Ahronoth. "Had Trump really wanted to move the U.S. embassy, he could have announced its relocation to a temporary residence in the capital the very next day. Instead, he said his team would look into it and maybe break ground some years hence, when a new president may be in office. His grand gesture, then, was simply words to placate evangelical Christians in his base, some of whom believe that Jewish control of Jerusalem is key to fulfillment of biblical prophecy about the end times. Trump fooled everyone." Our feature article this week, The Last Word, is titled, "Getting My Attention Back." "Like many people, I felt as if technology had sapped my ability to focus on anything," said writer Craig Maud. "So I went on a month-long retreat from all digital input. What followed was a revelation." There are 1,000 beautiful ways to start the day that don't begin with looking at your phone. And yet so few of us choose to do so. For 28 days last fall, I lived on the grounds of an old estate in central Virginia, next to a town called Lynchburg, making good on a residency I had been offered by the Virginia Center for Creative Arts. I had done other residencies and knew in order to eke out maximum productivity, internet disconnection was non-negotiable. And so it began. The day after the election, my month without the internet. It felt like a cop-out, like I wasn't allowed to escape the real world so easily. But the quieter my mind became, and the deeper I went into my own work, the more I realized how my always-on, always-connected state had rendered me largely useless. All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone, wrote Blaise Pascal. Did any of us remember how to sit quietly, alone, without a phone in hand? I certainly didn't. I had long since lost control over my attention. I want my attention back. It had been a long time since my attention was mine. I tried to think back to when my attention was something I could manipulate confidently. I couldn't remember. Was it pre-Snapchat or Instagram stories? Before everything was filtered through a real-time performance? Before every meal and outfit had to be posed, captured, and hashtagged? Or pre-Grindr or pre-Tinder? When fantasies born on the crucible of YouPorn, or is it Pornhub, weren't so easy to make real, nightly? Was I being too hard on technology? Technology is such an easy scapegoat, but it feels so right to point our fingers. It must have been the fake news. It must have been Facebook. It must have been Twitter. It must have been Reddit forums. It was none of these things. It was all of these things. Whatever it was, it robbed us of our attention and with that, our compassion. But the network never meant to harm us. Regardless, down in Virginia, on a repurposed plantation, I want my attention back. The thought wouldn't let go. In the last year, I had gotten myself addicted to the game Clash of Clans. Not purposely. I was in Myanmar on a research job and noticed all the farmers were playing it, atop their buffalo in the fields, where the 3G was strongest. I wanted to understand what compelled them to never put down their phones. 5 months into it, and I was fully hooked. I set a goal, some level, some league that seemed just on the edge of enough. Make it over that line and I'll pull the plug. What makes Clash of Clans so treacherous is that you are always building, sculpting. 5 months of work is really 5 months of work. Each additional day of play makes it that much more difficult to abandon. As I got closer to my goal, that mythical league on the horizon, I felt the algorithms turn on me. I sensed they knew I had a goal, and they turned that goal into an unobtainable carrot. Was I being paranoid? Maybe. The last day I played for 10 hours straight. Played the game slowly, a few minutes a day, over months, and the algorithms are insidious. Play the game in a manic burst, and suddenly the algorithms feel laid bare. I spent only $40 over those 5 months, but those last 10 hours were grueling. The closer I got to the goal, the more the algorithm would knock me down, set me up with what appeared to be easy wins, only to have me lose. Disheartened, I'd try again. This time beating someone against whom I should have lost. Over and over, this continued. It was so perfectly tuned to my most primitive set of chemical desires that it was actually beautiful, a thing of beauty. I could feel it moving beneath the screen, its tendrils and my neurons moving with an eerie synchronicity. But, of course, the lockstep relationship was weighted heavily toward the house. Just as victory was once again in sight, I was back to my position 10 moves and an hour prior. Where did it end? It was ridiculous. I was ridiculous. And maybe I was just a bad player. But I couldn't help shake that I was caught up in a con. A long, long con. I pulled the plug, deleted the app, deleted the Game Center account. The data was gone. I hoped. I haven't checked. A weight was temporarily lifted. In 1992, Bill McKibben spent many months of 40-hour weeks attempting to watch 24 hours of television as recorded on 91 cable stations in Virginia, at the time the most in the world. He wrote of his findings in the book, The Age of Missing Information. We believe that we live in the age of information, he writes, that there has been an information explosion, an information revolution. While in a certain narrow sense this is the case, in many important ways just the opposite is true. We also live at a moment of deep ignorance, when vital knowledge that humans have always possessed about who we are and where we live seems beyond our reach. An unenlightenment, an age of missing information. Today I could live on Twitter all day, every day, convincing myself I was being productive, or at least inducing the chemicals in the mind that make me feel like I'm being productive. Read more news, send more replies, start more threads, each incoming reply activating a corresponding dopamine pop, pushing nothing in the world forward. Maybe I lost my attention because I'm weak, lonely, pathetic. Maybe everyone else has total control. They can resist all the information spun by the algorithms, all the delicious dopamine hits in the form of red circles. Bing. Maybe it's just me. Did I really have it before Facebook? Thinking back, the early versions of Facebook were adorable. Benign. No tagging, no timelines, just the wall. A way to say, hey, what's shaking, dorm buddy? Poke. No algorithms. A human scale. The more I thought about my attention, the more I thought about the limits to human scale. How technologies amplify ourselves, the best and worst parts, in a way that is almost impossible for us to comprehend. How that scale is so easily co-opted to attenuate our attention with the worst possible diet of high sugar, high carb nothingness. Last year, Nintendo released its first iPhone game, Mario Run. It feels uncommonly fresh. I'm not a big gamer. Clash of Clans and Mario Run are the only two mobile titles I've picked up in earnest in the last, say, 20 years. But the difference between Clash of Clans and Mario couldn't be starker. Mario is finite, bounded. The edges are clear. You pay once, and there's no other way for Nintendo to extract money from you. In Mario, you can not only see the end, but you get there. Your points max out at 9,999. Mario Run is human scale. Clash of Clans is machine scale, network scale. When the scale of our systems with which we interact breaches our comprehension and control of attention is weakened en masse, the opportunity for manipulation arises. I want my attention back. For that month in Virginia, I took it back. I did the thing only the mega-entitled are allowed to do. I went offline. A scant 20 years ago, the entitled went online. Today, we go dark. A true privilege. I say only the entitled because that seems to be the pervasive notion. Oh, you get to stop checking email for a few days? Lucky you, friends say to me. Strangers say worse. If I tell people I went offline for a month, it's like telling them I set up camp on Mars. It hints of apostasy, paganism. Tribes seem to find pleasure in knowing all members suffer equally. But really, is the situation so dire that we can't wrangle a little more control? We've opted into this baffling baseline of infinite information suck, always availability. Nobody held a gun to our head. We put our own mouths on the spigot every single day. But it's so delicious. That spigot goo, buoyed by pull to refreshes and pings and wily dots, giving up attention, so seductive. Tristan Harris and Joe Edelman's Time Well Spent project takes aim at this thoughtless allure. Bianca Bosker's entire Atlantic profile of the crew is worth a read, but this passage really cuts to the heart of their work. While some blame our collective tech addiction on personal failings like weak willpower, Harris points a finger at the software itself. That itch to glance at our phone is a natural reaction to apps and websites engineered to get us scrolling as frequently as possible. You could say that it's my responsibility to exert self-control when it comes to digital usage, he says. But that's not acknowledging that there's 1,000 people on the other side of the screen whose job is to break down whatever responsibility I can maintain. In short, we've lost control of our relationship with technology because technology has become better at controlling us. 50 years ago, you could read all of the news in a single day. Grab the 2 or 3 papers and read. The information had edges. It could be understood by a single human over one cup of first wave coffee. The Virginia residency was a balm. It kept me sane at a moment where I was close to folding. As the month stretched on, I found my mind clear, excited, optimistic. There is a qualitative and quantitative difference between a day that begins with a little exercise, a book, meditation, a good meal, a thoughtful walk, and the start of a day that begins with a smartphone in bed. Work began early, continued long into the night after dinner. Wintry stars falling to the horizon were scrutinized. Breaks were had without phone in hand. Acres of woods were available to be walked in. Everyone was largely offline, although there were no strict rules about connectivity. We all worked on things that had no immediate value and spent time thinking over problems that were perversely meta. And yet, the quietude of those disconnected days evaporated as soon as I came back online. It was a shock to feel my mind returning so quickly to where it was before, namely, away, elsewhere, my attention so eager to latch onto whatever cleverly architectured spaceships of dopamine was flying out from my consciousness. It was clear that vigilance was required, some set of rules, and so here are mine. The internet goes off before bed. The internet doesn't return until after lunch. That's it. Reasonable rules. I'm too weak to handle the unreasonable. Total disconnection is a privilege, certainly, but I found it necessary to retreat and reset, to feel once again what it was like to have an attention without fighting for it each minute. In short, I recognized the need for self-care, and thankfully the residency came along at just the right time. Attention is a muscle. It must be exercised. Though attention is duplicitous, it doesn't feel like a muscle. And exercising it doesn't result in an appreciably healthier looking body. But it does result in a sense of grounding, feeling rational, control of your emotions, a healthy mind. Our measuring sticks for life tend to be optimized for material things, things easy to count. Houses, cars, husbands, babies, dollar bills. Attention is immaterial, difficult to track. We deserve our attention. Disconnection helped me remember what the mind felt like before I had lost my attention. Reminded me how it felt to wash off that funeral glaze that seemed to coat us all, and to return to the world, however thick the gloom, with clarity and purpose, able to help out in far better ways than I could have I stayed online. I wanted my attention back, and I've got it, for now. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared on backchannel.com. And we'll finish up the show on the Talking Points page. We have an article here that says, "The Economy. Should Trump Get Credit?" It's been a chaotic first year for President Trump, said John Crudell in the New York Post. But for all the sideshows, such as the Russia investigation and Trump's big mouth, the president has an ace in the hole, the economy. Under Trump, the stock market is booming, while gross domestic product has expanded at an annual rate of more than 3% for two straight quarters, following 8 years of anemic growth under President Barack Obama. The unemployment rate has dropped to 4.1%, a 17-year low. Trump took office vowing to create jobs, bring businesses back to the U.S., and loosen the regulatory noose created by Obama, said Liz Peek in FoxNews.com. His pro-business attitude unleashed a sea change in expectations among businesses, investors, and consumers. And their newfound optimism has Americans buying and investing again. The economy is certainly humming, said Keith Boykin in CNN.com. But job growth under Trump, averaging 174,000 jobs per month, is actually lower than the 2016 monthly average of 190,000 under Obama. When Obama took office, the economy was losing 800,000 jobs a month, and the Dow Jones had plunged to below 8,000. It was he who pulled the country out of the Great Recession and halved unemployment to below 5%. The truth is that Trump inherited a stable economy in the midst of the longest streak in history of consecutive monthly job growth. As for the stock market boom, that's an unsustainable sugar high, said Lawrence Summer in the Washington Post. Investors are giddy over Trump's financial deregulation and the GOP deficit-busting tax cuts for corporations, but productivity growth remains slow, and so does wage growth for the middle class. The so-called boom is built on a weak foundation. Still, the economy's vital signs are stronger than they have been in years, said Ben Castleman in the New York Times. Consumer confidence is at an all-time high. Household income is rising, largely because people have jobs and are working more hours. Most economists say Trump has had little to do with the rebound, but voters don't understand the subtleties of economic policy and usually associate the weight of their purse with the man in the White House. Look, if the economy were now slumping, everyone would be blaming Trump, said Monica Showalter in AmericanThinker.com. Since it's doing well, it's only fair to say that this economy is Trump's economy. And on some shorter notes, President Trump watches at least 4 hours and as many as 8 hours of cable TV news a day, and often keeps the TV on during meetings with the sound muted, according to 60 interviews with advisors, friends, and members of Congress. The shows on Fox News reassure him, while those on CNN and MSNBC get him fired up for combat in what he views as a daily battle for self-preservation. As of this week, there were 369 women running or planning to run for Congress in 2018, which would be the most women House candidates ever. President Trump's election, coupled with the country's sexual harassment awakening, are believed to be driving factors in this surge. Australia became the 26th nation in the world to legalize same-sex marriage last week. The Netherlands was the first country to take this step in 2000. Leaders or state media in at least 15 countries have used the term fake news to quell dissent and discredit reports of human rights violations. Among those who've embraced the term are Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and China's official newspaper, The People's Daily. And we will finish out today's show with a quote. This comes from Daniel Day-Lewis, quoted in W Magazine. He says, "The responsibility of a creative life is both a curse and a blessing. It's the thing that gives you life and is killing you at the same time." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.